Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Sonia Sotomayor becomes the nation's 111th Supreme Court Justice tomorrow when she's sworn in. The Senate approves another $2 billion for the Cash for Clunkers program, keeping it running through Labor Day. And President Obama meets with a key group of Democrats and Republicans at the center of the Senate's wrangling over health care legislation. Joining me in the studio for this week's Friday News Roundup, Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal, Michael Duffy of Time Magazine, and Susan Page of USA Today, who quite frequently sits in this chair. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good news from the Labor Department this morning, Jerry Seib. Tell us how important it is.
Good news and surprising news. The unemployment rate in July dropped by one tick from 9.5% down to 9.4%, which may not sound like much or a big deal, but I think it's pretty significant. First of all, almost nobody expected it to go down. Everybody expected it to go up at least a notch or two. It's the first time it's gone down in 15 months. And I think in terms of the way it will change perceptions of where the economy is going into Congress's August recess, I think it's a very it's a potentially very big deal, particularly if now there are a couple more months. One of the things it might mean is that maybe we will never get to this magic and dreaded 10% unemployment mark that President Obama warned the country about a couple months ago.
Big deal, Susan.
I think it could have impact on the health care debate because it gives the administration such a positive selling point going into the next couple weeks where health care is either going to survive or fall. Let's the administration argue that their prescription for the economy is working. That ought to build some credibility for dealing also with health care.
Do these numbers possibly mean the recession is ending, Michael?
Well, it looks, and across the board in other statistics, that things seem to have bottomed out or the rate of slowdown has itself slowed. And those are all good indicators. I think you could almost hear a sigh of relief from the White House this morning. They haven't had a lot of good news generally in the last couple of weeks. But there are other numbers this week that were almost as troubling. And the one that caught my eye, I think, in particular, was the report yesterday, which said that by the year 2011, nearly half of all homeowners will be underwater on their mortgage. This is an astonishing prediction, if true, that among people who hold prime mortgages that they will simply have more, they will owe more than they have equity in the house within 2 years. That suggests that there will be more foreclosures coming in. That's an additional drain. So things may have stopped getting worse. We'll see how long it takes to
and
improve.
You know, even if the recession is over, and I think a lot of economists agree that we're going to see some growth in the third quarter or certainly in the fourth quarter, signaling that the recession is probably older. That doesn't mean that the pain is over. And it doesn't even mean that unemployment will continue at this level. There's every possibility unemployment will go up, don't you think, Jerry? It doesn't mean we're out of the woods. Unemployment, as we know, is a lagging indicator. We could see unemployment get to 10% next year.
Right. And one of the things everybody who is smart will say in this phase is that don't conclude anything on any of these fronts from 1 month's numbers. You have to see something on growth or unemployment or foreclosures for 2 or 3 months before you really can say this is a trend, excuse me, and not an aberration.
But
so that's the caution.
Are the job numbers down because so many people have given up looking?
Well, that's certainly a factor. We know there are millions of Americans who either have given up looking, there's discouraged workers, or they're working part-time when they really want to work full-time. And so the unemployment rate would be higher. But that was true of last month's rate, too. So this decline from 9.5 to 9.4%, I think, is a real decline of people who say, I'm unemployed, I'm out there looking for a job.
Okay. As we continue our talk about money, let's talk about whether Treasury Secretary Geithner opened the door to a middle-class tax hike this week when he talked to George Stephanopoulos on ABC's program.
He certainly left the door open, as did Larry Summers, the top economic advisor at the White House. on a different Sunday show. That seemed to be very coordinated, led to a lot of speculation that the White House was intentionally leaving the door open to doing something that President Obama said he would not do during the campaign, which is raise taxes on families that make less than $250,000 a year. But boy, the White House came out and slammed that door shut. Robert Gibbs, in a briefing with reporters, I thought left no wiggle room on the idea that President Obama will not sign on to a tax increase for these families.
So what do you see happening? Are we talking about wiggle room or not?
I think they were talking about wiggle room, and I think the administration probably would be wise to leave itself some wiggle room. Look, here's the reality. The deficit is $1.8 trillion this year. It will probably be $1.4 trillion next year. It's very hard to see how, and by the way, along the way, healthcare will probably be paid for by taxing mostly upper-income Americans. It is very hard to see how, in the long run, you get out of those deficit holes taxing wealthier Americans one more time, which is what people are talking about now. So I think in the long run, they will have to figure out a way to backtrack on this, and they will probably do it by trying to do some kind of a tax reform in the next few years, which will not be revenue neutral. It'll change the tax code for everybody and raise some additional money along the way.
Mike Duffy.
I think the other piece of this is that they know from reading their poll numbers that public concern about the state of the economy, with the issue we were talking about a minute ago, is just a few points higher than public concern about the debt and the deficit. And they now have a sort of secondary, you know, public perception problem, which is that what are you doing? Sure, you're trying to fix the economy, you're stimulating the economy, you're worrying about healthcare, but what are you doing about our long-term economic health? And what are you going to leave our kids and grandkids? What kind of, you know, burden are we going to have left them? That is a topic that he talks about now regularly. He knows he can't actually fix it until the recession is over because there's no economic case for doing it. But he's got to keep that concern alive in people's heads if he's going to keep those numbers from getting out of control.
But what about George W. Bush's promise, mm-hmm. no new taxes?
Believe me, no president has forgotten what happened to George H.W. Bush when he said,
right.
read my lips, no new taxes, and then turned around and agreed to a deal that included raising taxes. And that's one reason. I think the last time we had a Jerry, you might know this better than I do. The last time we had the Congress voted for a tax hike was in 1993. Is that mm-hmm. right?
I think that's right.
So this is a whole Congress that has no stomach for raising taxes.
Experience.
And no experience raising taxes. It's a hard thing to do. Even though the NPR piece you mentioned this morning, Diane, included some data from the Gallup poll, which the Gallup for decades has asked people, do you paying too much, too little, or about the right amount of taxes? You probably don't need a poll to know that most people think they're paying too much mm-hmm. in taxes. But they found this year that had gone down a bit. Less than half people, I think 46%, thought they were paying too much in taxes. And a plurality thought their tax burden was about right. So that shows less angst about the tax burden than we traditionally see.
Susan Page of USA Today, Michael Duffy of Time Magazine, Jerry Zibe of The Wall Street Journal. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Well, after 18 hours of official debate spread across 3 days this week, Sonia Sotomayor won confirmation yesterday as the nation's 111th Supreme Court Justice, the first ever Hispanic, and certainly an historic moment for the nation's fastest growing minority group, Susan.
Yeah, we saw big celebrations in places like New York and Puerto Rico and California, where there are lots of Hispanics about this breakthrough. You know, there was, I thought, an interesting piece in the LA Times this morning, though, that said that she's a breakthrough in other areas, too. She's got diabetes, mm-hmm. which I don't know that we've had a justice before that had a chronic disease like that. She is the first justice who did not have English as the first language she learned. She grew up in a public housing project. There are any number of ways in which she is different in her background and maybe her perspective from almost all of the justices who have gone before her.
And I find myself wondering, are the types of hearings that the Senate's going to conduct in the future going to be different from that which we saw for Sonia Sotomayor.
Well, the hearings have become less illuminating for the last 10 years, and I think we can expect them to become even less illuminating going forward, not more illuminating.
How could they be less illuminating?
It's hard to imagine. Maybe they just stop having them. And there are some who think that that her performance in the hearings, which were as masked in terms of what she thought as several of her predecessors, really set the stage for a whole new round of hearings that don't really tell us very much.
So what do you do? I mean, what kind of hearings do you have?
Well, I'm not sure that we're going to have hearings are going to be, the way to understand justices, whether when they were great. We've seen Supreme Court justices really only explain themselves through their tenure on the court, through whether it's 20 or 30 years, and we've seen them be what people expect them to be. We've seen them to be completely different from what people expected. I guess the striking thing about the vote yesterday, which was, I think, 68-31 with nine Republicans joining all the Democrats except Ted Kennedy, is that we've seen another repeat, which is a pattern of a certain part of whichever power is party is in the minority voting in large numbers against the nominee, as we saw with Alito and Roberts. That's becoming now another standard piece of this drama, or melodrama.
That's, I think, the change here. I think the hearings become less useful, as Mike says, over time. You had 25 no votes for Roberts, I think 42 for Alito. You have 31 no votes for Justice Sotomayor. So you have a pattern emerging here. Honestly, I thought at the outset there would be fewer Republicans voting against her than did, because the wonderful life story and the fact that she does not change the ideological balance of the court in any real way that you can discern at this point meant it was going to be a relatively non-controversial pick. That actually didn't turn out to be true.
Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal. Short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the healthcare debate now going on across the country. Stay with us. And to you, Michael Duffy, give us an update on the latest Senate negotiations on health care.
In the Senate Finance Committee, which is the, I think everyone agrees, publicly or privately, the only body that's really important to watch here for the moment, is moving forward with a small group, a bipartisan group of senators, with a plan that would essentially have an individual mandate rather than an employer mandate, exchanges rather than a public option to provide health care coverage to people who either don't have it or want to move, expansion of Medicare and Medicaid. But this coalition is very frail, and it represents a very small number of people in the Senate. And like so many of the other panels that have put together their plans, they are operating behind closed doors. It's very difficult to tell where they're heading.
We're talking about six senators.
That's
is
right.
that correct?
That's correct.
Is the public option off their table?
Well, that's our understanding. They haven't said publicly what their plan is, but because the public option or the government-run plan that would compete with private insurance companies is unacceptable to so many Republicans, the Senate Finance Committee has looked for some kind of option that would address the desire for a public option but be acceptable to Republicans. So that's resulted in a lot of discussion of this idea of co-ops, which would be...
Does anybody understand them?
I have no idea. I would like Jerry Seib to explain this.
That's what Jerry's here.
Come to the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, the idea is to introduce a nonprofit alternative, which is supposed to be modeled over on agricultural electrical co-ops and agricultural co-ops, which, but that's about as far as anybody has taken the idea, that you get people together, get municipalities, states, whatever, and they establish insurance companies that are not run by the government but that are run as nonprofits, which, if you think about it, is how Blue Cross Blue Shield got started in the first place.
So what came out of President Obama's meeting with those six senators yesterday?
I think that the a lot of disappointment that the Senate Finance Committee, that not only did the Senate not pass a health care bill, which was the original timetable, but that the Senate Finance Committee has not even come out with their version of a plan so that the administration could try to sell it, or so that there would be talking points, defense of a particular plan when we go into this August recess and where members are having these town hall meetings. I think the White House is just about to pull the plug on the idea of negotiating a bipartisan deal with Republicans and go ahead with the idea of doing a plan that's going to be supported overwhelmingly by Democrats. Maybe you'd pick up a Republican vote or two, but they're I think this idea that it's possible to reach a deal with Republicans that will have significant bipartisan support, I think that is nearing the point where they want to move on.
Mike Duffy.
Well, I think it's a little ironic for the White House to be impatient with the Hill having said nothing about what it really wanted in the measure in public. So to accuse any group of senators to not having a plan without having a plan yourself that you're willing to share with people is rich.
Yeah. And, well, the two biggest players in this debate, the White House and the Republicans, neither side has a plan.
Yeah. So, and that's part of what's, you know, I guess, leading to these, you know, very unhappy situation for lawmakers of both parties who have to go home over the next couple of weeks and encounter all sorts of voters who ask completely reasonable questions like, what's in the plan and how will you pay for it and what will it do to me?
Okay, but there's a lot of disinformation out there. For example, these end-of-life discussions, Susan?
You know, we have been soliciting reader comments on our website about healthcare, which I've been reading over the last couple of days. And we've gotten a fair number of ones of people who believe that the Democratic plan and being developed would require them to talk to someone from the government about their end-of-life plans. You know, you can be for or against this health care plan, but it does not have this provision. What it has is a provision that would allow Medicare to pay for a session with your doctor to talk about end-of-life plans. If you wanted to have one, that Medicare would be able to provide, would pay for that.
If you wish to have that conversation.
It wouldn't require you to have that conversation, and there would be no government agency or agent involved in that conversation.
What about these protests around the country, Jerry?
Well, they're popping up a lot. They are fairly raucous in some places, and they are designed to intimidate mostly Democrats, although not necessarily all Democrats, to oppose the plan that was pretty much the plan that was drawn up in the House. And I think they will probably have some impact on the way this debate unfolds in September.
How are they coming about?
Oh, they're being organized by conservative groups quite openly. There's no secret plan here. They are saying to people, show up at a town hall meeting and voice as loudly as you choose to your opposition to the health care plan that Democrats are drawing up. And clearly their goal is to make sure that they are speaking louder than people on the other side. And so far, after 1 week's recess in the House, it sounds as if they're succeeding in doing that.
Here's an email from Lisa in Northeast Indiana. She says, I live in a very conservative Republican area. It does not appear that any of the Republican House representatives have scheduled town hall meetings during this recess. In our state, normally these Republicans do have town meetings, but not this year. I spoke with staff members of my representative, Mark Souter, and they have been very evasive as to why he refuses to hold a town meeting this August. Our local media hasn't been able to get an answer from him on this topic either. I believe they, congressional representatives, have had advance warning from House leadership not to host these meetings or any public events during this recess. Mike Duffy.
Well, if that's right, the points to the Republicans for being smart. I think that the most important number I've seen in polls about this recently that explains to me everything about the problem is that Time polled 1,000 Americans last week and asked them if they were satisfied or mostly satisfied with their health care coverage. 85% of Americans said they were either very satisfied or mostly satisfied with their health care. Now, against that, it's going to be very difficult to go out into the country and talk about a plan that doesn't exist yet. And I think that this is why the White House wanted to have something on the table before August, so this kind of chaos didn't take place.
So, to what extent is President Obama bound to come out with something more specific? Even during this recess,
I wouldn't expect the White House to suddenly come forward with a plan. But I think they would very much like to get the Senate Finance Plan out so they could talk about that. Talk about making some compromises with the Unified House Plan that came out. The real problem they've got now is that the people who are against this health care overhaul are really fired up and feel strongly. And the people who they think will be for it are much more ambivalent about it. Mm-hmm. People say they're happy with their health insurance coverage, but we all know people who have a pre-existing condition and have such a terrible time getting coverage, or who are staying in a job because of the health care coverage and not because of the job. And Americans are unhappy about that. You do hear the White House focusing mostly on these insurance reforms now and less on the idea of extending coverage to the uninsured, because that is a much bigger universe of people.
Plus, the key distinction, which is hard to make and which I think the White House has struggled to make, is that people like the health care they receive. They hate the system in which they receive it. But that's a tricky thing to convince people that you're going to address, which is to say, we're going to leave your health care, that is to say, once you finally see a doctor and you get your problem taken care of, we're going to leave that alone, but we're going to make this overly expensive, frustrating system in which you get it better. And that's a hard message to deliver.
And so didn't the White House somehow get into kind of a spitting match with the insurance carriers? Karen Ignani talked to the New York Times about her frustration since the insurance industry had initially come out in favor of reform.
Huh? Yeah, there are some players in the healthcare debate who have gone from, in the White House's view, stakeholders over the last week being called entrenched interests. There's been a little bit of a populist uptick in the rhetoric. At the same time, there was a story this week, I can't remember who had it first, about the White House cutting a backroom deal with pharmaceutical makers to limit the extent of the cutbacks that they would suffer under any new plan in terms of how much money the government paid to them for Medicare drugs. This was something that the White House arranged with Billy Tozen of the pharmaceutical industry. Whether the White House told the various panels on Capitol Hill about this, again, this is a White House that doesn't have a plan but apparently is making deals, I think was another awkward development for the president. And various players on Capitol Hill said, we're not going to be bound by whatever deals the White House
What makes. Has to happen for the U.S. to get health care reform?
I think that there will be a bill passed this year. It's the top priority of the president. They've got 60 votes in the House. They've got a big 60 votes in the Senate, a big majority in the House. I think there will be a bill passed this year, but it might be a more incremental bill, a smaller bill than the White House originally wanted. That said, Social Security started out as a much smaller program, grew and expanded over the years. But I don't think it's at the – I do not think one should assume that there won't be health care reform this year. I think there will be. It's just going to be possibly something smaller than what we thought it might have been a month or two ago.
And speaking of how things grow, talk about cash for clunkers, Jerry.
Well, who knew? It turns out the government put money on the table and people would take it. That's the discovery here. They put money on the table for people to turn in their cars and buy new ones, a generous amount, up to $4,500, and people said, sure. So I think there were two things going on. I mean, as everybody knows, I'm sure that money's already running out. The House has, and the Senate undoubtedly will, approve more money to at least continue the program through September and October. I think what happened is two things. A, it was a very generous plan, and people are not stupid. They'll take money if somebody gives it to them. And B, there has been pent-up demand here. I mean, let's not forget that people have been people have realized for more than a year that the economy is in really bad shape. They've pulled back. They've stopped making purchases. There are a lot of people who might have bought a car a year ago who have put it off. They now had a and have taken advantage of an opportunity to go ahead and do it. And so I think this is actually an interesting sign for the broader economy, which is if that's true and there's pent-up demand in auto purchases, there's probably pent-up demand in other parts of the economy when people start to breathe a sigh of relief. You might see it come out.
Mike.
I think, I may be wrong, but I think the Senate has passed it.
Yes, I think so too. Yeah.
But and it's worth noting that it got fewer votes than Sonia Sotomayor did, only 60 votes. You know, a couple interesting things about the Clunker's plan. You know, about half the cars were American-made, about half were foreign-made, or some of those were made in America. People tended to be turning in, you know, their pickup trucks and buying vehicles which are about 9 miles per gallon more efficient than the ones that they were giving up.
Ford's Explorer and the F-150 pickup topped the list.
That's right, and it's only a week and a half old or something, but they did move 200,000 cars, which is about 1/4 of an average month. But as everyone knows, this is a short time deal. It's going to end up, wind up in August. And I don't think it'll be renewed after that, but who knows?
You know, I have a theory on why it's been so popular, which is how often have you heard people say, the banks are getting a bailout, the insurance companies are getting a bailout, where's my bailout? And this was a sense that this was some bailout-type money that people individually could kind of claim.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Tell me about Secretary Geithner, Treasury Secretary Geithner, losing his temper, Susan.
You know, this was a story that the Wall Street Journal broke this week about what sounded like quite an extraordinary meeting between the Treasury Secretary, who by and large seems to be kind of a mild-mannered guy, and the heads of some federal regulatory institutions who have been opposing some elements of the Obama administration's plan for the financial industry. But since Jerry's paper had the story, maybe
we'll
he should describe
it. Jerry tell it.
Well, it was an interesting story, and we were happy to have it. There's been a problem in the administration's effort to get a financial regulatory change passed in Congress, which is that some of the agencies that would have their powers changed have been up on the Hill saying, well, you don't think this is a very good idea. Specifically, the SEC, the FDIC,
right,
thinking that too much regulatory oversight of the agency of the institutions they regulate would be handed over to the Fed. The Fed, at the same time, being not happy that there would be some kind of a new consumer protection agency that would take some regulatory oversight of consumer banking away from the Fed. So everybody had something to be unhappy about. And they were expressing that unhappiness to people in Congress who were already not convinced that they really wanted to do this because it's a leap into the unknown. So what Secretary Geithner did was he, at the end of last week, called the heads of all these agencies together, including Ben Bernanke and the Fed, and said, enough is enough. Stop complaining about this. This is what was going to happen. Get on the team and play ball.
And yet on Tuesday they were back on the Hill saying exactly what they were saying before because, you know, by the way, they're independent agencies. So Tim Geithner is not the boss of them. And they can say what they think to Congress.
Yeah, that's the most interesting thing about the whole thing is that we've had a suite of agencies which are related but not all answering to the president, which have worked together, you know, during this whole period of the last 8 months, hand in hand in most cases. But when it comes to changing the regulatory framework, they are not working hand in hand, and they are exerting their independent rights to say what they want.
What about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
This is a story that I think that the Washington Post had first, which is about a plan, and it's may not even be a plan yet, but it's among a series of options that are being talked about in the Treasury and particularly in the White House, the National Economic Council, to pull from Fannie and Freddie the billions of dollars worth of toxic assets they have not been able to repair or sell, create a bad bank, which is, you know, would be the repository of these this paper, and try to pull it off the books of these institutions, which are now being run by the government. I mean, these are both government now, fully government-run, you know, agencies. And it's still in the egg stage, but it caused a fair amount of, criticism when this option leaked. And what I guess both that story and a number of others this week reminded me that we are still at a point in the government's response to this recession where they're still trying things, and some things are working and some things are failing, and they're tossing them out 4 or 5 months later. You know, TALF is an example, where they have programs, they put them on the table, they see where they take the financial institutions they're trying to help or save or bail out, use your word. And some of them work and some of them are not working. And then they start again. And
well,
we're still in an experimental stage here, and this is one of those stories.
One thing that clearly did not work for Congressman William Jefferson was putting $90,000 into his home freezer, Susan.
It convicted this week of 11 of 16 counts of bribery and money laundering and racketeering. He's under the federal sentencing guidelines. He's likely to get 20 years in prison as a result. This person was a long-term member of Congress, a nine-term member of Congress from Louisiana, but defeated last December when he tried to seek a 10th term.
Susan Page of USA Today. Certainly, that was a big win for U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder. Short break. When we come back, your calls, your questions, and the post office. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. By the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. Fears of renewed sectarian violence in Iraq after a series of car bombs target Shiites. Bill Clinton secures release of two U.S. journalists from North Korea. And the leader of the Taliban in Pakistan may be dead. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And for the Friday News Roundup, it's now your turn to have your input to the program. Let's go first to Cropwell, Alabama. Tina, you're on the air.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Historically, in our area, the churches have provided the best hospitals. And it's a long history in America that has been the case. And I praise God for the level of health care that we already have. But I call about the integrity of the Speaker of the House, is she characterizes people at the town hall meetings coming with swastikas. I have not been to one yet. I don't know that we'll have any in Alabama. I've called one office, and there hasn't been, but I'm not affiliated with anybody. I'm simply a citizen, and I find that the misinformation, the abuse of office that's coming, where they're not listening to the people, but they're trying to present programs, is very, very disheartening.
Michael Duffy.
Well, I don't exactly know what Speaker Pelosi has said or has not said about the gatherings. I think that some of the reaction to in the town hall meetings is, as we talked about before, organized. I think some of it is a result, though, of confusion and not knowing what is coming, and a feeling among some Americans that they know that there's a health care reform plan coming. It's very difficult to explain. The details are not available. They're not likely to be available for another month.
And yet these protests are going to continue, even as they don't know what they're getting.
That's right. And this is a very difficult situation for the people who want to make health care reform a reality this year. And we have seen in the past that sometimes protests can really change the debate. And it's quite possible that we'll emerge at Labor Day in a different situation as a result of this.
I think these angry town hall meetings have had the effect of raising questions in people's minds, people who are not policy wonks following every in and out of the health care debate. Now, there is a possibility, though, as they go on, that they'll have a backlash. You have town hall forums where the member of Congress having the forum isn't allowed to speak, or where there's chanting that keeps the conversation, that is the reverse of what you're supposed to do at a town hall meeting, which is to have an opportunity to say your view or ask a question. I think there could be some backlash to that. But at the moment, I think that they have had the effect of muddying the waters for those who want health care changes.
All right, to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Diane and crew. Watching Congressman Dingell on TV last night do a town hall meeting, I'm not surprised that the conservatives are targeting this health care bill and manufacturing some anger, I believe, a little bit. But they do have their right. But what I'd like to ask your guest is, in this country, the true debate, I believe, is whether or not government... The right to health care is a natural right, or if it's a commodity to be bought and sold for a profit.
Jerry Stein.
Well, I think that's an interesting question that the country's never quite come to terms with. I mean, I think the country decided in the early 1960s that health care was a right for senior citizens, hence we have Medicare. I guess at some level, everybody agrees that health care is a right, but it is a right that the government should have a program that guarantees. I think that's a deeper question that really, in some ways, is at the heart of what's being discussed right now.
All right, to Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. With regard to cash for clunkers, I'm wondering, how is this a bailout for consumers if they're trading in cars that are paid off for a car that they have to finance? Isn't that really benefiting the banks?
Well, I'm the one who used the phrase a bailout for consumers, and it's a bailout because you get $3,500 to $4,500 of government money if you do it. So it helps you make that purchase.
I might add, it's also a bailout for newspapers, which are struggling. I noticed in the Washington Post this morning there were two full-page ads, which you don't see very often in newspapers anymore, advertising the cash for clunker deal. So maybe this has bigger ripple effects than I'd first imagined.
But here's another email on that subject from Tim. He says, you may think this cash for clunkers program is great, but where is the government getting all this money? It's borrowing the money from China or other foreign countries. The government is going to either have to raise taxes or print more money to pay off these loans. Then we'll have inflation. Sounds like a disaster.
And presumably, many of the people who are making the trade-ins and buying new cars with this money are themselves going into consumer debt, which just a few months ago, it was not hard to find people saying, well, we've had too much consumer debt, and that's what has to be brought back down to earth. So is the government operating in two completely and perhaps contradictory directions? Yeah, sure.
To Vero Beach, Florida. Malcolm, you're on the air.
Good morning, Diane and company. I have sort of a two-pronged question. I've been trying to pay attention to the health care reform debate, and two things that seem to be missing from the dialogue. One is the trying to eliminate the practice of defensive medicine that doctors are forced to perform to keep their malpractice insurers at bay. They order needless tests to keep the ambulance chasing lawyers happy. And as a result, they get less time to spend with their patients. Many doctors today who are primary care doctors book six patients an hour, so they can't diagnose anything. because that's all the pay they get from the insurance company. So as the cost for primary care goes down, the quality goes down as well, because you can't diagnose anything in 10 minutes except order a bunch of tests. The second thing that I think has been missing from the dialogue, it was in this morning, I think, in the journal, estimate somewhere between $50 and $75 billion a year in fraud. Nobody seems to be talking about it.
All right. Jerry's out.
Well, I think Malcolm gets to an important point that's kind of being lost amidst all the shouting, which is the very crucial question of whether anything that's being discussed now will actually bring down the overall cost of health care to the country. You know, one of the things that administration officials are very keen on is making sure there are provisions in here that change the way medicine is practiced in ways that would reduce costs. One of the things conservatives complain about is that one of the things that's not in the legislation is malpractice reform, something that puts a cap on malpractice rewards that might stop doctors from, as the caller said, practicing defensive medicine, ordering up a bunch of tests, putting people in hospitals when it's not necessary, simply to protect themselves. And I think that is, in the long run, as important as anything else in this debate, which is can something be done that changes procedures in a way that holds down the long-term cost of healthcare? Because that's what the government really needs, because otherwise the deficit is not going to go away if the cost of the government's healthcare programs aren't reduced.
Any other comment here? Thanks for calling. And to Johnson City, Tennessee, good morning, Katie.
Oh, good morning, Diane. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
My father was a pathologist, and we owned medical laboratories. And it is in the interest of all Americans to have universal health care. Microbes and infections don't ask if you're rich or poor, if you're insured or not. In the last pandemic, 18 million people were killed. It behooves us all to have coverage. It behooves us all to have doctors. We need it now.
Thanks for calling.
You know, we've focused on the things that divide on the healthcare debate, but it is interesting of the things about which there is a consensus. There is a general consensus in town for an individual mandate that says you have to have health insurance. You're required to have it, just like if you're a driver, you're required to have car insurance. And that gets to the idea of moving very close toward universal coverage, as Katie is saying. You know, there's also an agreement on trying to do these insurance exchanges where people who have to be on the individual market or small businesses will have some of the advantages of big businesses,
right,
of kind of buying insurance in bulk and having big savings that way. So while we've talked about the really tough hurdles ahead, the fact is this debate has come a long way.
I was going to just say that we, one detail we left out of our discussion earlier about the Senate Finance Committee plan, which is still emerging, is that it appears to be heading in one direction Katie was talking about, which is they seem to be shooting for at least 90% of people would have coverage, which would be a huge step forward.
I thought it was even more than 90%.
It might have been 94.
Yeah.
I just wasn't sure the exact number.
Okay.
With, you know, paying for it in ways that are still to be determined.
I mean, Susan makes a good point. If you take the elements on which there's actual agreement, insurance reforms and steps toward something closer to universal coverage, you might have here the makings of the incremental health care bill that could pass this year, and that starts the process rather than ends the process of health care overhaul.
All right. Let's talk for just a moment about the post office. They have said they've got to address a potential loss of $78 billion. $7 billion, sorry. Go ahead,
There
Susan.
Was an extraordinary number in this discussion this week, which is that the post office this year will handle 27 billion fewer pieces of mail than they handled last year. It's because of this thing they call the internet.
Yeah.
You know, people are not writing letters the way they did their corresponding over the web, and it's had this devastating effect. I mean, you get the sense that the post office is going the way of the Pony Express with the decline of people using snail mail.
Well, the other thing is that I open my mailbox and it's filled with catalogs, not mail, which, as you say, you're getting over the internet. So what's going to happen? You cut out Saturday mail?
I assume you start there. You do what businesses do, which is you cut back to the things that actually allow you to get the, you know, the balance sheet in balance, and that you probably start by cutting personnel and expenses, and that would be a logical starting point.
Then that probably means you start to consolidate and close some post offices.
Right.
And post offices here in the district as well.
I think they put out a list this week of 700 post offices that they were going to close.
Around the country.
Correct.
Yeah.
St. Louis had, I think, the most. But you know, all big cities, which have lots of post offices, most of the ones they were closing on the list or proposing to close are actually in federal buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And military installations.
I'm going to miss Saturday delivery if that happens.
Well, you'll have more time then.
I'm not sure there's much you can do about it.
Okay, let's go to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Diane. I'm curious why whenever I watch the Sunday morning talk shows or listening to stuff on the radio, when people are talking about unemployment and health care, the discussion is always takes place between people who are employed and have health care. There are millions in this people in this country without either. None of those people can ever get on these shows and discuss what the real problems are. I feel so bad for you, Diane, that you're going to miss Saturday mail delivery. My wife and I don't have health insurance. Which do you think is a higher priority for me?
Bill, I'm glad you called because I think with this kind of program, we do have an opportunity to hear from folks like you. You just reminded us. What does it mean for you that you do not have health insurance? He hung up. Now, that's too bad. I mean, if you've got that opportunity to say it on the air, you ought to use it. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Jerry.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, you know, I'm happy to be employed and have health insurance for myself and my family. One of the things journalists do at a time like this, I'll plug journalists, is that they tell the stories of people who aren't so lucky. I mean, that is a very vital function, and it's never more obvious than in a time when there's a debate like this going on.
And to Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Kareem.
How are you doing, Diane?
Fine, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm 30 years old, and I recently left a job in the public school system to start my own business. And so consequently, I pay for my own insurance, but also 3% of my income towards Social Security. Now, I think probably many in my generation, am happy to pay into the social fund because I think I have a social obligation to do this. But if voters can't extend a public option to people like me, people in my generation who are healthy, why should we continue to fund theirs in the form of Medicare? Why should I have to pay for John Boehner's health care? And if I can just throw one more thing, and I don't think that this is a generational thing. Last, you know, a couple months ago, my mom had her knee replaced on Medicare, and she's pretty wealthy, and asked to pay for more of the procedure and was denied. So I paid for her procedure. What's the deal?
Gosh, that's quite a story,
you know,
Susan.
We talked earlier about how for a lot of Republicans, a public option is a deal breaker. For a lot of Democrats, the failure to include a public option is also a deal breaker, or they say it is. They feel a lot of Democrats in Congress feel very strongly that this is a big cost saver, that it's a safety net. It ensures people there's going to be a plan that they can be a part of. So this is clearly going to be one of the final knots that gets untied with health care reform.
Yeah, and I think that this is one place where the White House actually anticipates the final showdown, because the Senate is moving away from a public option. The House absolutely wants one. If it gets to conference, they're going to have to come up with some mechanism that makes both sides happy. And they've even talked about what that might be, where you start with these exchanges on a private basis, and if they aren't satisfactory or they don't do their jobs or they don't do whatever else the standards that the Congress sets for them to do, there is this triggering mechanism where the public option then takes over or is suddenly a possibility. It's possible that will end up
CNBC that way. Is reporting that Senator Mel Martinez of Florida, Republican, is resigning.
He has talked in the past about stepping down, or at least talk to friends about it.
Why?
Well, I just remember from the immigration. The most telling story about Martinez in my mind is that in the immigration, he fought very hard to get an immigration compromise. I think 3 years ago, thought he had his caucus all lined up, and then it fell apart. He was very disappointed. He is interested in statewide office, I think, in Florida.
Running for governor.
Well, he was already announced he wasn't going to run again for re-election, so it's not a surprise he's going to be leaving the Senate. I think it is a little bit surprise to me that he's going to step down. Now, that could give, you know, that could have an effect on who succeeds him, because it gives, there's an appointee that gives them a kind of head running start to winning the seat next
and
year.
And from Politico, he made the announcement at a morning staff meeting, said he will not be returning to the Senate after the August recess, even after saying last December that he would be serving out his term. Interesting. Thank you all. Michael Duffy of Time Magazine, Susan Page of USA Today, Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal. Let's hope that before long we have a few more details of what this health care reform could be. Thanks for listening, all. Have a great weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.